railroad train, a good old pal to me. Take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
Oops, get a microphone, yes.
This is Dave Bunker, Prairie Monk, WAFT, Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board, and today is Sunday, October the 21st, 2018, and this is the Prairie Monk program, WEFT's weekly look at rails, trails, greenways, conservation, and whatever Dave has been up to this past week.
This week I thought I'd do something on irrigation. Sometimes it helps to talk to items that you have had quite a bit to do with. So after I graduated in agricultural science, I was appointed to an agricultural high school in the Murrumbidgee irrigation area. So I got to be familiar with irrigation. And so I want to bring some thoughts to you about that. It is an age-old event. If you were in your early days, I was in an area where we had 80 inches of rain sometimes, but other times we had a drought. But all the wastewater from commodes over the night would go to the vegetable garden, and that's a form of irrigation. If we were short of water, we would also go down to the local river and bring back buckets of water. You often had a yoke, and you could have a bucket on either end of that yoke. And many Chinese gardens, for instance, were watered in that manner. Early on, in biblical times, the Middle East, Mesopotamia, and other places had irrigation. They used the Euphrates and Tigris to water the desert. But it failed because when you water a desert, the desert has had no, or little leaching, so the chemicals, the salts, are in the surface, and if you irrigate, you incorporate those salts in your irrigation. That means you have to have very good drainage to remove that salty water, and if you don't do that, you get salting, and trees die, and your irrigation system dies. So there is some groundwork that you need to know if you're going to be in an irrigation system. So as you move up the pole, you get to be taking water out of the river, and even then you start to take water out of the aquifers underneath and a little above both. The Ogallala Aquifer is drying up rapidly between Nebraska and Texas, mainly because it's being used for irrigation water. The Colorado has long since dried up to the point that where it enters the Pacific, it is a small volume of water, and it's very, very salty. So there are huge advantages to this if you do it correctly, and there are some disadvantages. If you're in the United States, you look at the Mississippi River, and you look to the Missouri and rivers running right up into Canada, and they surround the mountains, and there is a drainage basin. Australia has a very similar system. It's about the fourth biggest drainage district in the world. You have a north-south escarpment of one plate moving over another, and then to the west, as you gradually remove yourself from the mountains, which allow clouds to rise and then precipitate, you get drier and drier. Those corridors also get to be very wet at times, and often early settlement was via the rivers, as it was in the U.S. At flood time, you could take a paddle wheeler up the river. If you were lucky, you got there before the river level fell. If you missed that, you might spend 1, 2, or 3 years sitting on a dry river basin until another flood came. So there were sites along the Murray, Murrumbidgee, Darling rivers and all their tributaries, Castlereagh and others, that allowed people to settle, and in good years they could have thousands of sheep and cattle, and it was very prosperous. But then came a drought, and the drought lasted for more than 1 year, and all that productivity, wool and mutton and beef and dairying, went down the drain. People were starving, people were dying, cattle were dying, sheep were dying. And a guy named Alfred Deakin, who was fairly young at the time, later would be a three-time Prime Minister of Australia, decided that something should happen. He had an idea that irrigation might be helpful. So he started to read, and he found out that there was not a lot to read about in this event. So he started to travel. And he was aware that California had done some interesting things with irrigation. And he found a couple of brothers named Chaffee that were doing interesting things. The Chaffee brothers were Scottish in background, Canadian in upgrowth. The elder brother was George, and the younger brother was fairly younger and a horticulturist. The older brother was an engineer, and he had been doing interesting things with riverboats on the Missouri and other places. He'd moved into the U.S., and then he got together with his brother. He had another brother, Charles, too, who came in later. And they poked around in California to find that there was areas where there was good soil, but no water. And they bought land for a low price and then irrigated it and did very well, to the point that they created a small town. They were well known in California, and so Alfred Deakin, looking for a way to do something with the western part of Australia and that huge drainage basin that goes out into the Australian Bight, he visited, and he found these people very interesting, and they didn't exactly want to come to Australia, but they got such good reports from reporters and people who were traveling with the Deakin team, that eventually they came to have a look. and they decided they could probably do something about the situation with the complex of Murray, Murrumbidgee, Darling rivers that ran into the South Australian Bight. In the US, they had laissez-faire, and it, when they bought land, they bought land, and there weren't too many controls on it. When they reached Australia, it was much more politically a democracy, but it was controlled administratively as you would control convicts that were sent there early. So there were many more regulations and laws. So gradually the Chaffee family, mainly George, had to do a lot of work with the Victorian government and the Australian states at that time were not federated yet. So there was some conflict between New South Wales and Victoria because the border between the two states was along the river. Let's go back a bit. Australia was founded in 1776 when Cook had done early exploration, and it was an opportunity when the convicts could no longer be sent, or inscripted people could no longer be sent to the U.S. and U.S. colonies. The U.S. had gone independent, so Australia was a likely site. Australian soils have been under the ocean for a long time. If you look at Australia, there was an inland sea, and most of Australia was underwater and leached, so the soils are the products of leaching. Sedimentary soils like shales and gravels and limestones and not very productive. So when the early settlers arrived, probably in the early 1800s, up to probably about the 1820s, 24, it was a struggle. The settlers arrived to a site that was very dry, not very productive for planting plants or keeping cattle. At the outset, Aboriginals were very generous in their support of teaching these people, these strangers, how to survive. They did that until they realized that the intent was to take over their territories, which did happen. So then they got to be more antagonistic and would have battles with the encroachment. So by 1920s, Australia was looking at expanding over the mountains to the slopes. And there were various explorations that went towards Adelaide that exists now, or the Great Australian Bight. And they didn't really stumble over the outlet of this basin that included the Murray, the Murrumbidgee, the Darling, and eventually emptying out into the Bight. But gradually, early paddle wheelers moved up the rivers as they were flooded in spring. There was nearby on the coast almost a Kosciuszko Mountain about 7,000 feet, high enough to be snowed, and that snow provided water for the rivers. especially the Murray. Chaffee looked at this and said he thought you could do something. He was wanting to do a grand plan. It was to take a small town that was in bad shape because of the drought of Mildura in Victoria and create an extension of that town, which had main streets that were wide and trolleyed and with public service places, a place for public service, like shire seats, and a main drag to be named after Deacon, the man who had he got the Chaffees there. And they then encountered a whole lot of debate. Is this an American takeover? Was this using water that didn't belong to them? So it took a long time. And eventually, it didn't work. And this was involving several years. But at the same time, South Australia, another state bordering the part of the river complex, decided that they could do something. So they decided to do something of the same plan at Renmark, where they were on the territory. And that turned around the state of New South of Victoria, and so then now the Chaffees have two sites to develop. The soils were good. He had been to station properties and noticed that the vegetable gardens, when watered, were doing very well. So he set forth a plan. He was rather a brilliant organizer, and his plan was eventually approved by the Victorian government. And it has, over the years, been extremely successful. He opened up, bought large territories within the framework of the government, so that the government had some control over this. The land was purchased from station owners that were overly joyed to get away from the drought-stricken system. And he gradually developed the site. He looked at meanders, and when your river moves, it moves in a sigmoid curve and often creates what in Australia is called a billabong or oxbow lake. And he figured that he could fill that lake with water and pump to a higher situation so then that the water could drain into drains. Now, let me explain what happens in that sort of gravity irrigation. You can have an open space like a paddy for rice, and you can flood the whole acreage for a certain time to get the rice to grow. Or you can have channels. If you have fruit trees, for instance, you can have a channel that has a sluice gate, and when you want to water your orchard, you allow the water to run down this ditch, and you have a shovel, and you put your mud as a blockage, and the water runs into that tree. Then you remove the blockage and go to the next tree. And this is a stunt that I have grown up with. If you're short of water, those sluice gates have some control on them. They have a meter so that you don't overwater and somebody else down the road doesn't get any. But Chaffee was designing pumps. At the first, he would take a paddle wheeler and put it at the front end of the billabong and use the engines there to do the pumping. It was a poor facsimile of what he wanted, so he made contact with his English background and got people to design centrifugal pumps that wouldn't have belts and other things associated with them, but would do a good job of lifting the water to a greater height, and then a subsidiary pump would take it further and further. He was well aware that it takes fruit trees sometimes 7 years to yield. Some plants will do it sooner than that. But this was going to be a challenge. He had subsidiary people in England that knew how to work with mass media in the sense of they produced a red book which explained what they were doing and why, and it was key to making it possible for this project to work. And they had all manner of people from very wealthy to peasants who came to Australia, some of them from Europe, some of them from Ireland. There was the response to this proposal was very positive, and it led to the creation of a new town. Everyone that came first had to ride bullock tracks and rough roads for hundreds of miles, and no train reached this site, but boats reached the site. But as I explained before, the boats only could run in a flood season, and sometimes it was it was huge floods. So the captains of these ships were very knowledgeable, and they would even take risks of taking their paddle wheelers over farmland where there were fences and trees, and they were game enough to help settlers who were in jeopardy survive. So paddle wheelers were a part of this. Trains were coming in, but they didn't reach this area. This was more or less desert with mallee. It's a shrubby tree with huge roots, sometimes 8 feet in circumference or even more than that. So they would take out these trees, and that involved a lot of navvy work, even sometimes dynamite to remove the roots, and then they had to plow the ground and prepare it, and they had to have entrepreneurs that would sell, and there were always the people, as usual, that take advantage. Some people would sell legitimate fruit trees, others would sell fruit trees that didn't bear anything, and you didn't know it till 5 years later that it didn't happen. So there were the whole area was a dry area. You didn't have alcohol, and some of the people that were coming were used to drinking, and Australia is dry, and drinking is a part of their habit. So you had law enforcement, and you had to have people who didn't necessarily put people in jail for long periods. You had to make sure that they were able to hold their heads high and survive. And there was lots of camaraderie. And these people still weren't earning money, except that the Chaffees were paying salaries to people who did work with early tractors, the early steam tractors, which stood in one place and had a hawser going across a field so that a piece of agricultural equipment could be pulled from one side to the other. They're getting very near the early automobiles, and in the long run would have buckboards, which is a name for a car that's been converted to a pickup truck with a flat board. And these vehicles were in the era when tires were very large. That meant that they could go over rough terrains without problems. It was a little bit on the religious side. Almost the project was a religion, although the Chaffees especially were not religious people. They were from Scotland via Canada, via the U.S. Eventually they legitimized the site by bringing their families. George had four children. The brother had five, and they made Mildura their home. And they were the leaders of the push. They didn't have a lot of delegation. They hired a lot of people to do the work, but they were holding the purse strings and the control. This is not unusual with a lot of projects. I hearken back here to George Fell and the Nature Conservancy, where he was a powerhouse in his own right and kept it that way. And so these people did something the same. They were the organizers, and they were very much approved of. As things started to grow, politicians came and looked, and gave us this project world respect. If we go back to some of our own things, I like to think of this sort of organization working here. If you're looking at something like a desert of prairie where there is no prairie, then you need fairly desperately leadership that will look at 5, 6, 8, 10 counties to do something to preserve an almost extinct ecosystem. How do we do that? So as you look at this developing town, and eventually they were sending out huge amounts of wool and fruit, and they got very innovative. They tried taking all manner of horticultural things. The second brother, William, was a horticulturist, and they brought in every possible plant you could imagine. In some cases, they were in competition. They brought in apples, and apples did well, but they were in competition with Tasmania, which was sort of, by that time, an apple base. had occasions when there were other irritations, like locusts are a form of insect that can devastate your efforts. And there were rabbits. There were so many rabbits that they had to get rid of this with a rabbit-proof fence. And rabbits in Australia are burrowing rabbits. They were brought in by Philip. Philip was the Governor General that came with the first convicts. And Governor Philip had brought rabbits as part of bringing livestock to a new site. And they escaped, and eventually the rabbits are a huge problem in Australia. Chaffee went around and put in rabbit-proof fences. That meant they go under the ground at least 9 inches so that a rabbit cannot burrow through. They were also trying to keep out coyotes, a dog that got to be invasive, and the fences were usually high enough that a kangaroo could not jump over them. They had to be high to do that, and kangaroos got to be imaginative. They could find ways of dropping down on a fence so that they could then get over it. So it wasn't easy, but community was there, and community was important. They brought in music and then drama and post office and telephone, and they were still isolated, no railroad. And for some reason, the railroad didn't come quickly, even though they tried to do that. But eventually, the railroad did come through because Broken Hill was nearby, and Broken Hill was a mining town where they mined for silver and other ores. So eventually, the train did come through, but most of the products went out by paddle wheeler. The Chaffees were innovative in that sense too, because they had a shipping yard, a building ships at Mildura, and they discovered that a paddle wheeler with one paddle wheeler at the back was not as efficient as one with two wheels on either side. So they changed the shipping things. And so this became an inland port, a little like you have in Houston and other places in the Southwest. But an amazing amount of product was going out. And the tonnage is quite amazing, because really you're talking about 13 inches of draft on some of these places. The river captains had to know and understand a river that doesn't necessarily stand put. A flood may break through a meander and cut off and leave a meander scar or billabong, and the river is quite different than it was before the flood. So these people were experts in adapting to the present situation. Chaffee was no mean engineer. He had, while he was in California, he had started electricity for Los Angeles. And people didn't really know that much, but they had the early electricity came from a Chaffee experience. And then they had this farm area where things were doing very well. So they had world recognition for what they were doing. Could this sort of thing be done in India? Could it be done on the Nile? There were lots of questions. So these men had international fame. And gradually the area began to be very supportive, and I have to recognize a book that I was familiar with. It's Water into Gold by Ernestine Hill. And she has documented a lot of these sorts of things. But I was on the Murrumbidgee, which is one of the three major rivers. And we used irrigation water to have plots of land that supported the agricultural high school where I was teaching. Kind of muddy in a way, but it's how rice grows. Gradually, you have to realize that what happened in the Murray River started to happen on the Murrumbidgee, and it happened also on the Darling. And even it went right up into Queensland, where the Darling Downs were behind that ridge. And it's, in some cases, Queensland was thinking of putting in dams on the advanced side of the mountain range and driving it through into the drier central. At one stage, it was thought that if Australia could recreate a lake air in the middle of the Australian deserts, and let seawater in, that would change the nature of the center. It never happened and probably won't ever happen, but these schemes were being considered. So where I was teaching, the Murrumbidgee irrigation area was probably an offshoot of the early Murray River debates. Eventually, the Australian states federated, and that made things somewhat easier. By the middle 20s, Mildura was doing well, and so were other communities like Leeton and Griffiths on the Murrumbidgee, Naranda, and other places like that. You have to think then that gradually they're starting to think about who owns what water. Victoria has some of the Alps which provide the snow, and so they feel that they have the right to take water out, a considerable amount of water out at Mildura. And New South Welshmen were saying that they also own some of the Alps and some of the water. And there have been various ways to make the whole river navigable. There were locks and dams that were put in, as you have something like 29 locks on the Mississippi. You also had locks and dams. The idea is that you bring the ship up at the lower level, you open gates that allow that ship to move into a lock, and the water is allowed to come in from the high dam side, and that lifts the ship up to a new level, and so you can use those corridors as transportation corridors, and that happens very much on the Mississippi, and it still happens on the Murray River Basin. And but the paddle wheels were replaced by trains, and they're now tourist attractions, or they're remnant museum pieces. The trees remain along the river, the red gums that are characteristic of Australia are still there, and it's fairly natural. But as people get more short of food and short of water, there's a move to not only take water out of the river, but to take water out of the aquifers. So the Ogallala Aquifer that services Nebraska down to Texas is drying up. And that's so with a lot of aquifers. Our own aquifer, the Mahomet aquifer, has a slow movement from the Vermilion County area across from Indiana, across the state, and it exits into the Illinois River at Beardstown. That slow movement was east to west, but now as we have huge center pivot irrigation where a mechanical system sprays water on an area and makes a circle, and then there are square pivot irrigations, and often they're on morainic soils that are a little bit gravelly and earlier in season. So if you irrigate and water well, there is the chance that you might just get two crops per year. So there are economic advantages. But that water that used to flow east to west is now, if you're west of Champaign, that water is flowing to Champaign because there's a huge cone of water being taken out by irrigation. So we have to figure, do we want to put all this water into something like corn that goes to alcohol? So do we really need the vehicles that we have that demand this procedure? There's huge arguments if you start to ask questions about water and who's using what. There are legal arguments about who gets to take out what water first. And if you were an early user, you have often legal rights to take out more water than perhaps you should do these days. So we have to think about irrigation and what we can do with it, and that's worldwide. So I think that's probably enough to say about irrigation for the moment. So then let's look at some of our own areas where we have concerns that are more than just local. If you're in the Midwest and you're losing your prairie, how do you do a chaffy-like thing where you find experts that are willing to not only look at the prairie that we don't have and try to preserve it? Do you have leadership that is not necessarily knowledgeable, like Alfred Deakin, who was eventually the three-time Prime Minister of Australia, not knowledgeable of his own waters, but aware that something might be possible? So then he goes looking around the world for people who have expertise, and that's how he found the Chaffees. And then he needs people like editors of the Sydney Morning Herald or the Argus to gradually alert the public to the need. It also requires a red book, like the red book that the Chaffees had in London, where you alert the rest of the world to the fact that this is also their ecosystem. It's not just your ecosystem to abandon. And half the people that are here, who are people who even the Quakers were taught how to exploit. That's the word, exploit the forests and the places that they came to. How do we change that attitude of it's a railroad bed, we need six or eight more rows of corn, and we have the power to do it because we can be ourselves. Then once you try to put in a regional planning office which would look at these rail beds and say, excuse us, but we don't want you to put in a huge recreational trail which is going to take out a lot of our remaining, not the best prairie, but the only prairie that we have. How do we get together and work cooperatively to save that? That means you have to go to the federal government, the state government, and to the Association of Highway Engineers and Transportation Officials to establish a principle that rail trails should not be so recreational that they take out all the vegetation on either side. So it is possible to find a family of Chaffees that then will know, as Deegan did not know, he just had the idea that this should happen. How do you hire people who have expertise? And often they're very few. We have them in a state historical survey, which was put together by Forbes. We have them in the Nature Conservancy, where Vestal and Shelford and Kendi worked to form a ecological union. How do we get that union to encourage and to help George Fell to go to Washington and create a Nature Conservancy? How do we then see George appointing his board, but it's mainly a George board because he does his homework. But then one of the board members wants to do something with Long Island and Barrier Islands, and that has precedence over putting together chapters all across the country. So more or less, George got fired. So then he came to Illinois, and for 23 years he worked with the Illinois Nature Preserves Commission, the Department of Natural Resources, various institutes, and he put together forest preserves. The forest preserves got a little bit recreated by people who decided that they should not only preserve forests, but they would like to have recreation. That was superseded by people like George Fell to include conservation areas. If you're in a forest preserve and you're in Champaign County, there was very little forest. It was 94% prairie. So do we need a forest preserve or do we need a prairie preserve? And constantly we find people planting forests. Sometimes they plant them right on top of what was the prairie. So they created once again, George Fell had a lot to do with this, a conservation district. So Vermilion County is a conservation district. That means you can preserve prairie and you can preserve the non-forest areas. If it's forest, then it's forest. You go back to forest. But let's make sure that we don't lose our ecosystem. There's one about a mile section at Oakwood that Doris Westfold used to collect seed for prairie restoration or prairie planting at Vermilion County, and she's kind of locally famous for doing that. If the current dictates that go with the rail trail movement and the Association of American Engineers for Transportation and Highways gets into the act, that bed will be removed. So we need leadership that is prepared to stand in front of this plan at the federal level, at the state level, at the union level of engineers. We need to educate people, and that comes from the specific people in places like the Natural History Survey, or with agencies like the Sierra Club, the Isaac Walton League, the Audubon. We need the Grand Prairie Friends, who have done very well with taking on prairie preservation, but it's hard to do because prairie is good for corn and soybeans. In some rambunctious territories, it's still good for cattle, but basically it's good for row crops. And how do we stand and talk to the populace generally to make sure that this sort of trail work does not destroy the little bit of remaining prairie that we have. So in there somewhere, we need to hire people who will take on this task and move it forward. And somewhere out there, we have people who are beginning to get attuned to this sort of work. So we have a master naturalist and a master gardener territory within the domain of agriculture. And so they're on different wavelengths. One is interested in genomes that will improve the quality of the corn yield. Mm. They will have genes that can handle a Roundup and get rid of weeds. We have some rather horrible chemicals that are being used at the moment that spread to other fields. How do we work with Monsanto and others to make sure we have a reasonable yield? And how do we look to grow a soybean crop or a counterpart to soybeans that is perennial, so you don't have to plant it each year and have it erode the ground? Some of our ground is 200 feet deep and it's rich, but some of our ground is more skeletal, and we need that special effort. So education is a part of this, and we look for jobs that make it possible for people to dream about preserving the dignity of their ecosystem, which is not only belonging to us here, but it belongs to the rest of the world. In the 1930s, we didn't have soybeans. We went around the world and collected glycine plants from all over. We should be able to do the same. If somebody else wants to produce a plant that is useful, then they need to be able to go to other countries like Illinois and find a gene pool. But if there's no gene pool, then you're fresh out of luck. Mm. And let me see how we...
You have 5 minutes.
5 minutes. So I think as I look to closing out some facilities, then I look to find other people who are in a different age bracket. When the Chaffees were doing their interesting work, they were in their 20s and 30s. And they lasted for a long time. And Sometimes the progress was limited, but I think we need to inspire that sort of person. And so then I am aware that some of these things include how we work with big organizations where we are going to put in, hopefully, a big development around the MTD building. And then you have to do like the Chaffees, think about what are the retreats or niches or interests that make a community work. The loss of a little prairie across the road has been rather serious to people who enjoyed it and used it a lot. Can we have recreational trains, historic trains, come into Champaign? Can we think about a bus system which will include a train and a bus? Can we take people to some of our 13 or 14 ecosystems? Great. So that we know what we have and what is left or not left. One of the interesting things is that this weekend we have had an arts council. So there was Chaffee encouraging drama and music. And so the Folk and Roots organization is a part of an overall mechanism. And so, David, did you were you part of Folk and Roots this week?
I sure was. For the 10th year, there's been 10 years of the Folk and Roots Festival. Way back at the very beginning, I knew a couple of the founders that started the Folk and Roots Festival, and I said, if you get me a few harmonicas and find me a place to sit down that afternoon, I will give harmonicas away to people and teach people the basics of how you play it. And I've come back every single year and I've said, okay, can you get me a few more? Can you get me a few more? So every year for some number of years now, 5 or 6, they've made sure that I had 20 harmonicas. And this year, something odd happened for the very first time. I had about a dozen people, but more people showed up with their own harmonicas than wanted one from me. So I ended up taking home something like 15 harmonicas, which is about all I'll probably need, I guess, for next year. But yes, I did my usual 2-hour workshop. One really cool thing, there's a Methodist church there over on Race Street, just south of Lincoln Square. And I've only been in one other church on in town, and that's the McKinley Church on campus. And I know from being in there, that's where Amazon always has its concerts. I know from years and years and years of being in there what amazing sound churches can have. And walking in, my workshop was in the sanctuary, the main churchy part of this Methodist church, and the acoustics were just what it really meant is it was very cacophonous because all of the not quite together sounds that people were making were echoing off the amazing walls of this church. But every once in a while, I would play something solo, and it just sounded beautiful because that space was designed for sound to be enhanced. So it was fantastic. Well, I'm sure I'll be back doing it next year. I tend not to promote it on this show because it seems like it's, I don't know, it doesn't feel right. But yes, I got to do it again.
I think you need to expose yourself to these small pieces go together to make the whole.
Mm-hmm.
And if Chaffee had 300 employees, they were the people who were digging the trees out or working with the ships. They were a team, and I think we need that team. So as we go into a big development around the MTD building, then we should be willing to look at the peripheries where people could not only find a pub, but also find other things that are interesting and useful to do.
Sure. And that's about it.
That's my rant for today.
You have 15 seconds.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. As always, the views and opinions expressed are solely those of the speakers and no one else. It's now noon, and that means it's time for Shruti, Music of India, here on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM.